readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, as a mother of two, is honored to dedicate this show to moms. Yes, moms, we've survived to celebrate another year. The ups, the downs, the challenges. Yes, did I mention the challenges? But gentlemen, no need to tune out. Our salute to Mother's Day is not all frills and frippery. We moms know how to get down to business and have interests as varied as Du Bois. You'll be glad you stayed with us as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Here's the book everyone, and I mean everyone, is talking about. Even people who never pick up a book have asked me if I read it. 50 Shades of Grey, book one of the 50 Shades trilogy by E.L. James. It's been called erotic, amusing, and deeply moving, but is it worth all the buzz? We need to preview it. But warning, warning, warning. Folks who've listened to this title don't like, in fact, let's say despise the narrator, Becca Bateau. Even though the book has just been remastered, readers are still in an uproar. Devotees of this trilogy feel the narrator may ruin your experience, so this is one you might want to pick up and read in print. Here's the story. When literature student Anastasia Steele goes to interview young entrepreneur Christian Grey, she encounters a beautiful, brilliant, and intimidating man. The unworldly, innocent Anna is startled to realize she wants this man, and despite his enigmatic reserve, finds she is desperate to get close to him. Unable to resist Anna's beauty, wit, and independent spirit, Grey admits he wants her too, but on his own terms. Shocked yet thrilled by Gray's erotic tastes, Anna hesitates. For all the trappings of his success, multinational business, vast wealth, a loving family, Grey is a man tormented by demons and consumed by the need to control. When the couple embarks on a daring, passionately physical affair, Anna discovers Christian Grey's secrets and explores her own dark desires.
It's early, and I don't have to be in Seattle until 2 this afternoon. Fortunately, Kate has lent me her sporty Mercedes CLK. I'm not sure Wanda, my old VW Beetle, would make the journey in time. Oh, the Merce is a fun drive, and the miles slip away as I hit the pedal to the metal. My destination is the headquarters of Mr. Gray's Global Enterprise. It's a huge 20-story office building, all curved glass and steel, an architect's utilitarian fantasy, with Gray House written discreetly in steel over the glass front doors. It's 1:45 when I arrive, greatly relieved that I'm not late as I walk into the enormous and frankly intimidating glass, steel, and white sandstone lobby. Behind the solid sandstone desk, a very attractive, groomed, blonde young woman smiles pleasantly at me. She's wearing the sharpest charcoal suit jacket and white shirt I have ever seen. She looks immaculate. I'm here to see Mr. Grey, Anastasia Steele for Catherine Cavanaugh.
Excuse me one moment, Miss Steele.
She arches her eyebrow as I stand self-consciously before her. I'm beginning to wish I'd borrowed one of Kate's formal blazers rather than worn my navy blue jacket. I have made an effort and worn my one and only skirt, my sensible brown knee-length boots, and a blue sweater. For me, this is smart. I tuck one of the escaped tendrils of my hair behind my ear as I pretend she doesn't intimidate me. Miss Kavanaugh is expected. Please sign in here, Miss Steele. You'll want the last elevator on the right. Press for the 20th floor. She smiles kindly at me, amused, no doubt, as I sign in. She hands me a security pass that has visitor very firmly stamped on the front. I can't help my smirk. Surely it's obvious that I'm just visiting. I don't fit in here at all. Nothing changes. I inwardly sigh. Thanking her, I walk over to the bank of elevators and pass the two security men who are both far more smartly dressed than I am in their well-cut black suits. The elevator whisks me at terminal velocity to the 20th floor. The doors slide open, and I'm in another large lobby. Again, all glass, steel, and white sandstone. I'm confronted by another desk of sandstone and another young blonde woman, this time dressed impeccably in black and white, who rises to greet me. Miss Steele, could you wait here, please? She points to a seated area of white leather chairs. Behind the leather chairs is a spacious glass-walled meeting room with an equally spacious dark wood table and at least 20 matching chairs around it. Beyond that, there is a floor-to-ceiling window with a view of the Seattle skyline that looks out through the city toward the sound. It's a stunning vista, and I'm momentarily paralyzed by the view. Wow. I sit down, fish the questions from my backpack, and go through them, inwardly cursing Kate for not providing me with a brief biography. I know nothing about this man I'm about to interview. He could be 90 or he could be 30. The uncertainty is galling and my nerves resurface, making me fidget. I've never been comfortable with one-on-one interviews, preferring the anonymity of a group discussion where I can sit inconspicuously at the back of the room. To be honest, I prefer my own company, reading a classic British novel, curled up in a chair in the campus library, not sitting twitching nervously in a colossal glass and stone edifice. I roll my eyes at myself. Get a grip, Steele. Judging from the building, which is too clinical and modern, I guess Gray is in his 40s, fit, tanned, and fair-haired to match the rest of the personnel. Another elegant, flawlessly dressed blonde comes out of a large door to the right. What is it with all the immaculate blondes? It's like Stepford here. Taking a deep breath, I stand up.
That was 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. When American journalist Pamela Druckerman has a baby in Paris, she doesn't aspire to become a French parent. French parenting isn't a thing like French fashion or French cheese. No, French parents insist they don't do anything special. Yet, the French children Druckerman knows sleep through the night at 2 or 3 months, unlike those of her American friends. French kids eat well-rounded meals that are more likely to include vegetables than chicken nuggets. And while her American friends spend their visits resolving spats between their kids, her French friends sip coffee while the children play. In Bringing Up Bébé, One American Mother Discovers the Wisdom of French Parenting, Druckerman finds child-rearing is a very different experience in France. French mothers assume that even good parents aren't at the constant service of their children, and there's no need to feel guilty. They have an easy, calm authority with their kids that Druckerman can only envy. With a notebook stashed in her diaper bag, Druckerman, a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, sets out to learn the secrets to raising good little sleepers, gourmet eaters, and relaxed parents. She discovers that French parents are extremely strict about some things and strikingly permissive about others. and she realizes that to be a different kind of parent, you don't just need a different parenting philosophy. You need a different view of what a child actually is. Abby Craden narrates.
Why don't my French friends ever need to rush off the phone because their kids are demanding something? Why haven't their living rooms been taken over by teepees and toy kitchens the way ours has? And there's more. Why is it that so many of the American kids I meet are on mono diets of pasta or white rice, or eat only a narrow menu of kids' foods, whereas my daughter's French friends eat fish, vegetables, and practically everything else? And how is it that, except for a specific time in the afternoon, French kids don't snack? I hadn't thought I was supposed to admire French parenting. It isn't a thing like French fashion or French cheese. No one visits Paris to soak up the local views on parental authority and guilt management. Quite the contrary. The American mothers I know in Paris are horrified that French mothers barely breastfeed and let their four-year-olds walk around with pacifiers. So how come they never point out that so many French babies start sleeping through the night at 2 or 3 months old? And why don't they mention that French kids don't require constant attention from adults, and that they seem capable of hearing the word no without collapsing? No one is making a fuss about all this, but it's increasingly clear to me that quietly and en masse, French parents are achieving outcomes that create a whole different atmosphere for family life. When American families visit our home, the parents usually spend much of the visit refereeing their kids' spats, helping their toddlers do laps around the kitchen island, or getting down on the floor to build Lego villages. There are always a few rounds of crying and consoling. When French friends visit, however, we grown-ups have coffee, and the children play happily by themselves. French parents are very concerned about their kids. They know about pedophiles, allergies, and choking hazards. They take reasonable precautions, but they aren't panicked about their children's well-being. This calmer outlook makes them better at both establishing boundaries and giving their kids some autonomy. I'm hardly the first to point out that middle-class America has a parenting problem. In hundreds of books and articles, this problem has been painstakingly diagnosed, critiqued, and named: overparenting, hyperparenting, helicopter parenting, and my personal favorite, the kindergarten. One writer defines the problem as simply paying more attention to the upbringing of children than can possibly be good for them. Another, Judith Warner, calls it the culture of total motherhood. In fact, she realized this was a problem after returning from France. Nobody seems to like the relentless, unhappy pace of American parenting, least of all parents themselves. So why do we do it? Why does this American way of parenting seem to be hardwired into our generation, even if, like me, you've left the country? First, starting in the 1980s, there was a mass of data and public rhetoric saying that poor kids fall behind in school because they don't get enough stimulation, especially in the early years. Middle-class parents took this to mean that their own kids would benefit from more stimulation, too. Around the same period, the gap between rich and poor Americans began getting much wider. Suddenly, it seemed that parents needed to groom their children to join the new elite. Exposing kids to the right stuff early on, and perhaps ahead of other children the same age, started to seem more urgent. Alongside this competitive parenting was a growing belief that kids are psychologically fragile. Today's young parents are part of the most psychoanalyzed generation ever, and have absorbed the idea that every choice we make could damage our kids. We also came of age during the divorce boom in the 1980s, and were determined to act more selflessly than we believe our own parents did. And although the rate of violent crime in the United States has plunged since its peak in the early 1990s, news reports create the impression that children are at greater physical risk than ever. We feel that we're parenting in a very dangerous world, and that we must be perpetually vigilant. The result of all this is a parenting style that's stressful and exhausting. But now, in France, I've glimpsed another way.
That was Bringing Up Bébé by Pamela Druckerman. Brad Meltzer is a New York Times best-selling author, the host of Brad Meltzer Decoded on the History Channel, and he's amazingly famous in the comic book world. Raised in Brooklyn and Miami, Brad is a grad of the University of Michigan and Columbia Law School. One of Brad's books, The Book of Lies, is about the missing murder weapon that Cain used to kill Abel, as well as the unsolved murder of the Superman creator, Jerry Siegel's father. Brad is actually one of the only people to have interviewed Jerry Siegel's family about the murder, and with his charitable site, OrdinaryPeopleChangeTheWorld.com, has been the driving force behind the movement to repair the house where Superman was created. Another of his best-selling books, The Inner Circle, is based on the idea that George Washington's personal spy ring still exists today. While researching that book, former President George H.W. Bush gave Brad, for the very first time, the secret letter he left for Bill Clinton in the Oval Office. Brad was even recruited by the Department of Homeland Security to brainstorm different ways that terrorists might attack the U.S. Brad is a great friend of the Book Report. You'll find our first interview archived in the December 11th show on bookreportradio.com. Brad joins us now again to speak about his newest work, one that is very close to his heart. Here is For My Daughter. Welcome, Brad. Thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
Always good to be back. Thanks, Elaine.
So, after you published Heroes for My Son, your daughter Lila ramped it into high gear, waiting for her book, right?
For 2 years now, my daughter's been saying, "Where the heck's my book, Dad? Come on, TikTok." She's like my editor. But 6 years ago, on the night my daughter was born, my heart doubled in size. And like I did for my son, I said, "I want to write a book that lasts her whole life that I can give to her and teach her how to be a good woman. Show her examples of heroes who can be those real, not just words to her, but be examples of that the impossible is truly possible." And I started with heroes like Sally Ride. And people know Sally Ride is America's first female astronaut in space. But the question to me is, why her? Of all the amazing women in the country, why did NASA pick her? And some say it's because Sally Ride was a genius at physics, and others say it was because she was this amazing athlete, she was a tennis player, and some say she was just fearless, and those are all true, Elaine. But here's what also had to happen. If Sally Ride had to see an ad in her college newspaper looking for volunteers, and she had to answer it. She had to see an opportunity, and she had to seize it, and I said, I want my daughter to learn that lesson. And so that's what Heroes for My Daughter is, one-page stories, just that one moment of greatness from people like Amelia Earhart, Christopher Reeve, Rosa Parks, that will really be heroes for my daughter. And that's where the book was born.
And the obvious question, how did you decide who would make the cut?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. In an odd way, choosing heroes is like the Supreme Court definition of pornography, which is you know it when you see it. Right? And for me, there were heroes. Every hero in Heroes for My Son could be in Heroes for My Daughter, and every hero in Heroes for My Daughter could be in Heroes for My Son. But one rule is no one's in there for being famous. I tell my kids all the time, you know what it means to be a professional athlete? Nothing. It means you're good at sports. You know what it means to be a best-selling author? Nothing. It means people buy your books. That doesn't mean you're a great person. What's great is what you do beyond yourself, beyond your God-given talent. And to me, it was funny. When I handed in the book, my editor said to me, "We have one problem." I said, "What's the problem?" She said, "You use one word over and over and over in all these descriptions." And I said, "What's the word?" She said, "Fighter." I used the word fighter in over a dozen descriptions. I used the word fighter in the Dalai Lama's entry. He's a pacifist, and I called him a fighter. But here's what I won't apologize for. I want my daughter to learn how to fight. I want her to know that if she wants something, she should fight for it, and if she sees injustice, she should fight harder than she's ever fought before. And I tell her all the time, don't be the princess waiting for the prince to come rescue you. You can rescue yourself.
You know, that reminds me or brings to mind a thought that you chose from Winston Churchill, which is, I loved it. You have enemies? Good. That means you've stood up for something sometime in your life.
Yeah, no, in fact, a woman brought her book to me and she asked me to sign it. And for the, I don't even know why. I just like to write different things in different books. I wrote Make the Right Enemies. And then she actually emailed me a couple days later and said, I don't know how to explain that to my daughter. And then I said, read the Winston Churchill page about making enemies. And if you have enemies, that means you stood for something. She said, I love this. And I think, you know, we always want to be so protective of our daughters. We don't realize how resilient they are.
You know, I also found Wilma Rudolph's story so inspirational. She had polio at age 4. She couldn't use her left leg, but then she went on to become an Olympic athlete. Talk a little about her.
Yeah, no, Wilma Rudolph is actually the last famous hero in the book. It's one of my favorite stories in there. And, you know, a woman I had ever actually heard of. And as you said, when she's born, the doctors say she'll never walk. She gets polio. They put her in metal braces. Her mom rides with her in the bus back and forth to doctor's appointments. When they finally take off the braces, not only does she walk, but she runs faster than anyone. And she wins a bronze medal in one Olympics, then the following Olympics wins 3 different gold medals. The only woman to do 3 in that Olympics, which is incredible. She becomes the fastest woman on the earth. And what I love is her quote at the end where she says, "The doctor said I'd never walk again. My mother said I would. I decided to listen to my mother."
And I'd like to share with listeners your quote, which was, "Without a doubt, how you start in the race matters, but it doesn't determine where you finish."
Yeah, no, and that's what I love that. I appreciate that. You know, for every runner, we always know how you come out of those starting blocks. It's so vital to how you do. But Wilma Rudolph is proof that, again, it doesn't show you how far or how fast you go. And I think that that's a vital life lesson. And the, you know, the hero after that, Wilma Rudolph in the book, is a very personal hero. It's my grandmother. And when the book came out last week, it came out on what would have been my grandmother, who passed away last year, would have been my grandmother's 94th birthday. Mm. And she's in the book. When my grandfather died, she lost her husband. My family said she'll never go on because she loved him so much. She went on for over 20 years. And then she went blind, and they said she'd never go on, and she went on. And then she went nearly deaf, and they said she'll never go on, and she would go on always. And I'd see her on weekends, and I'd yell into her hearing aids. I'd say, "Nah, how you doing?" And she'd always say the same thing. She'd say, "Oh, I'm doing okay, darling. I can't complain." And I'd always think, "You can absolutely complain. You're blind and you're deaf and you're a widow. How could you not complain? You're nearly deaf here." And to her, though, she had everything because she had family.
Yeah.
But for you, Elaine, and for your listeners, the best hero in the book is on the last page because the last 2 pages are blank. And they say your hero's photo here and your hero's story here. And I promise you, you take a picture of your mother, your grandmother, a teacher, a military member, your family. You put their picture in this book. You write one sentence of what they mean to you. You don't just have a great Mother's Day present. You have the single most important hero in Heroes for My Daughter.
Yeah, I want to let every listener out there know that this is like one of the most amazing gifts for Mother's Day. What a wonderful keepsake, actually.
Yeah, and that's what we designed it to look like. We wanted it to be a keepsake. We wanted it to be something that you hand down generation to generation. So we have people who, yes, they may buy it for their young daughters, or they buy it for their graduating college seniors or high school seniors. But we have people who buy it for their daughters who just had a baby. And they put their own hero in the back of the book. And then that, you know, then their daughter one day hands it down to another generation. And you really do have a keepsake of heroes in your family. And I think that, to me, is the best legacy. You know, we always focus on these big famous heroes, but I like reminding people that sometimes the best heroes are the ones we live with and see every single day.
Yeah. Talk a little about how you selected the photography for the book. Each hero has an amazing picture attached to it.
Yeah, every hero story is 2 pages long. On the right-hand page is the 1-page story. On the left-hand page is a photo of them. And I chose every photo in that book. Every photo was vital to me, that you don't see the standard photo of how you know them, except for Lucille Ball, because she's the one where she's at the conveyor belt eating chocolate, and I just love that photo. But otherwise, it's one you've never seen. I wanted you to always see the hero in a light you've never saw them. So if we're going to do Amelia Earhart, we're not going to do the one with the scarf and the goggles that everyone knows. We do one that makes her much more human, looking like one of us. And it is the reminder that this book is not about famous people. It's about what we're all capable of in our very best days. And in fact, as I was researching it, and as we were picking photos, and as I was looking at them, I was also looking for clothing for my daughter. And I kept looking around, and all I would find were clothes with princesses on them. And I thought, I have so many better heroes than that. And so I had a friend of mine, a cartoonist, Chris Eliopoulos, a well-known cartoonist, draw a picture. I said, "Draw a picture of Amelia Earhart for me." And I wrote below it, "I am Amelia Earhart." And on the back, I wrote the words, "I know no bounds." And my daughter loved this shirt. And then my wife said, "I want one." And then we went to the estate of Amelia Earhart, and they loved it. And we actually launched a clothing line to go along with the book. It's called Ordinary People Change the World. You can see it at ordinarypeoplechangetheworld.com. And we teamed up with the estates of Amelia Earhart, Lucille Ball, Muhammad Ali. We have George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Eleanor Roosevelt. And the goal is to let people and show them the real heroes that they should be wearing on their chest, not princesses, but true American heroes. And it's my core belief. You know me, Elaine. I believe ordinary people change the world. And I don't care how much money you have or where you went to school. That's nonsense to me. I believe in the power of ordinary people to change this world. So if you go to ordinarypeoplechangetheworld.com, you can see the entire clothing line.
All right. Well, Brad, thanks so much. The book is a joy to read and also to keep. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Elaine. Always appreciate it.
All righty. Bye.
Great. Bye-bye.
In this irresistible memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, best-selling author Anna Quinlan writes about looking back and ahead and celebrating it all. Using her past, present, and future to explore what matters most to women at different ages, Quinlan tackles, to cite a few, marriage. Quote, a safety net of small white lies can be the bedrock of a successful marriage. Parenting, quote, being a parent is not transactional. We do not get what we give. It is the ultimate pay-it-forward endeavor. We are good parents not so they will be loving enough to stay with us, but so they will be strong enough to leave us. Our bodies, quote, I finally recognize my body for what it is, a personality delivery system designed expressly to carry my character from place to place. It's like a car, and while I would love a red convertible or even a Bentley, what I really need are four tires and an engine, unquote. From childhood memories to manic motherhood to middle age, Quinlan, who performs the book, uses the events of her own life to illuminate ours. Along the downsides of age, she says, can come wisdom, a perspective on life that makes it satisfying and joyful.
It's odd when I think of the arc of my life, from child to young woman to aging adult. First, I was who I was. Then I didn't know who I was. Then I invented someone and became her. Then I began to like what I'd invented. And finally, I was what I was again. It turned out I wasn't alone in that particular progression. I began to discover that 25 years ago, when I created a column about my own life for the New York Times called Life in the 30s. The 34-year-old mother of two little boys, I was shaky and unsure, wondering whether their stories of sibling rivalry and toilet training, my stories of household juggling and family accommodations, would have any resonance outside the walls of our home. I got the answer to that question soon enough. From kitchens in Winnetka and Austin and Westport and Chevy Chase, the messages arrived. You are writing my life. My sons do the same thing yours do. My friends offer the same solace. The moms in my playgroup have the same advice and issues. Sometimes people would suggest I must have been eavesdropping in their living rooms. Often they would report that they had put a particular column on their refrigerator. Fridge-worthy, one woman said of a piece I wrote about lightning bugs. As I sat in front of my primitive computer, typing as fast as I could because I never knew when I would be interrupted by the appearance of the toddler in the home office or a howl from the baby from the floor below. I could imagine that fridge, a fridge like the one in my own kitchen, with its collection of Sesame Street magnets and blurry family photos, emergency phone contacts, and preschool schedules. I feel like I'm not alone, some of those who wrote to me said. And that sentiment changed my life. That's what's so wonderful about reading, that books and poetry and essays make us feel as though we're connected, as though the thoughts and feelings we believe are singular and sometimes nutty are shared by others, that we are all more alike than different. It's the wonderful thing about writing, too. Sometimes I would think I was the only person alive concerned about some crazy cul-de-sac of human behavior. Then I would get the letters from readers and realize that that was not the case, that we were not alone, any of us. Often we felt as though we were. We were living odd patchwork lives in those years because of an accident of timing. We were the daughters of women who had moved directly from their parents' homes to those of their husbands, gone right from high school to marriage and motherhood. But my friends and I had gone to college, entered the work world, under the rubric of the new woman, suddenly able through vast changes in societal mores to use our abilities in the world and combine them with a domestic life at home. We were the heiresses to a women's movement that had broken the world wide open. But we were completely making it up as we went along, at work, at home, in our own minds, trying to be both our mothers and our fathers simultaneously. That wasn't easy. One of the great unspoken effects of all of this was a vast loneliness that went untouched because it went undiscussed. The women's movement had famously created consciousness-raising groups in which feminists discussed their grievances. But there was no corollary for those who had found so many of their wishes fulfilled and yet found this unfulfilling, exhausting, or even impossible. While the women of our mother's generation felt constrained not to complain that no wax floors and bridge parties were not exactly stimulating, we didn't want to admit that trying to balance a couple of challenging full-time jobs was kind of a stretch. We were all a little happy and a little crazy and a little sad and a little confused. And we all thought it was just us. That's what makes life so hard for women. That instead of thinking that this is the way things are, we always think it's the way we are. My last Life in the 30s column began with a one-sentence birth announcement. Her name is Maria.
We've just heard Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake by Anna Quinlan. Readers, ask anyone who knows me, and they'll tell you that after reading, my next favorite pastime is shopping. So, I am absolutely thrilled to have Alexandra Wilkes Wilson as my guest today. Alexandra, along with the other A, Alexis Maybank, are the co-founders of The Gilt Group, the company that's revolutionized high-end online shopping. Alexandra and Alexis both went to Harvard as undergrads and continued on to Harvard Business School. Early in their careers, they took different paths. Alexandra worked for Merrill Lynch and then on to luxury retailers Louis Vuitton and Bulgari. Alexis was an early member of the eBay team, launching eBay Canada, and she was instrumental in the launch of eBay Motors. In 2007, the pair launched the Gilt Group, and in only 4 years, attracted 5 million members and earned a $1 billion valuation. Their new book, By Invitation Only, shares their incredible story. Readers, it's not all about shopping. It's a wonderful book for entrepreneurs and people who are thinking about starting a business. Welcome, Alexandra. Thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
Thanks for having me.
I want to say flat out, I love the book, and it's so much about business and entrepreneurship and working with people you trust. It's a wonderful book, and it's not all about the shopping, which, of course, I love to shop too. let me ask you, whose idea was the Gilt Group?
So as you probably gathered in reading our book By Invitation Only, starting Gilt Group was really a combination of forces. We have five co-founders. And I wrote the book with one of my co-founders, Alexis Maybank, who's also a longtime friend. And we were inspired by a love of sample sale shopping. We would duck out of work. I used to work for companies like Louis Vuitton and Bulgari, and I live in New York City and got invited to some of the best sample sales, which means basically access to designer brands at really, really steep discounts. And the concept of Gilt Group was to recreate that excitement in an online way, so giving members across the country access to designer fashion for prices up to 70% off.
I want to ask you, so many people say never mix business with friends or family, yet your partnership has been so successful. Can you share some tips about that?
Sure. Well, you know, you do hear that saying, don't go into business with a friend, but there are a lot of examples of friends going into business, and there are even more examples of family members, so siblings, husbands and wives, partners, parents, etc., and it can get really complicated. So we have a checklist in our book. We call it the Business Partner Decision Checklist, and we just are big fans of communication. So before you actually start working together, talk through a lot of the issues, over-communicate. Don't let the business relationship businessify your friendship. For us, we always wanted our friendship to come first. In terms of picking out a business partner, before you get started, if you're really close to that person, think through it. Talk about things like, how are you going to fight? How do you can't fight. If you're siblings, you can't have a crazy sibling cat fight in the middle of a professional atmosphere. So you got to talk through that so it never happens.
After you and Alexis and your core team began to work together, how long until the site was actually launched?
Gosh, we launched our business really quickly, a lot faster than the process of writing a book, which took us a couple of years. So our business, Gilt.com, launched November 2007, and our engineers, our co-founders, had started coding the site just the spring before. So it was really a matter of months, about 4 months, before we turned the business live.
Wow, that's amazing. I know that Zach Posen was your first designer. How did you get him?
Yes, Zach Posen was our first designer on Gilt Group, and that came from a personal relationship of mine. My job functionally at Gilt has always been to source the brands that we sell, and I had met Zach and his family in 2003 through a summer job that I had, and we had written a business plan for him also while we were in business school. And basically, it took relationships, but a lot of convincing, and not only Zach Posen, but hundreds of designers later, making them feel comfortable with our concept to sell not only online, which a lot of brands didn't do back in 2007, but online at a discounted price.
Which of the designers were difficult to bring on board right at the beginning?
Oh, they were all difficult in different ways, and we write a lot about that process in By Invitation Only. So it doesn't matter what kind of business you're starting. If you think about how you get those initial brand partners or vendors, it's really tough because one of the first questions they're going to ask is, well, who else are you working with? And when you're at the very beginning, that list is going to be pretty tiny. So relationships were critical. And also making people just feel comfortable with us as people, knowing that we were high integrity, we weren't going to do anything to damage their brand name, and making our brand partners feel like they were a part of our entire process. That was really important. And also our site, just like the name of our book, our site was By Invitation Only. So that gave brands a lot of confidence because whatever they sold on our site was password protected and therefore not searchable through Google.
Well, now Gilt has expanded into furniture, food, travel. How do you see the company evolving?
We have expanded so quickly. We're in men's and home and food and travel and Gilt City, which has local city experiences across the country. And that has been really exciting. I think what we're focusing on right now as a company, one area is mobile. So for any of you who have an iPhone, iPad, Android, et cetera, you basically have access to a store in your pocket or in your handbag. And that's pretty exciting. And our mobile technology is very advanced, very easy to use. It's almost frighteningly easy to use. And the other area we're focused on is personalization, so that the experience you have really makes sense for what you care about, your sizes, your preferences, what kind of seasonal temperature you live in, et cetera. So we're still having a lot of fun. Even though we're 1,000 people now, our employee base, we're still really a creative and innovative bunch.
Yeah, I mean, your site is such a pleasure to use, and there's so many wonderful choices. Okay, I noticed that Mark Cuban, owner of the Dallas Mavs, has written about your partnership. So is he a guilt shopper?
You know, I met Mark on a panel we did together for MTV and for Inspiring Young Entrepreneurs, and he was very supportive of guilt. He knew it well, big fan, and he certainly knows a lot about entrepreneurship and investing in good ideas at good times.
Mm-hmm. All right, so talk a little bit about the book. It is a really wonderful read.
Thank you. It's called By Invitation Only, and my guilt co-founder, Alexis Maybank, and I wrote it to inspire entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial thinking across the country, especially among women. We just feel that about 40% of new businesses right now are being started by women, and that's amazing and that's exciting, but such a tiny, tiny percentage of those businesses are getting funded. And we just want to help increase the chances of success for all businesses, doesn't matter who's founding them. And if we can do that, if we can explain the ups and downs that we've faced along the way and hopefully teach some powerful lessons and even inspire others, then we'll feel really good about what we've done.
Well, readers, I want to stress this is a fabulous book to pick up. It's entertaining, informative, and I just think you're going to love it. Alexandra, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All righty. Bye. Girls, if we set our minds to it, our options are limitless. So, a 40-year-old cheerleader? When Laura McManus, a single mom in Ohio, told friends she wanted to be an NFL cheerleader, they said it would never happen. In It's Not About the Pom-Poms, how a 40-year-old mom became the NFL's oldest cheerleader and found hope, joy, and inspiration along the way, Laura McManus proved she had spirit and pom-poms. But before she stepped onto the field as the oldest cheerleader in the NFL, she was sidelined by a bad marriage and a stay-at-home motherhood. She finally got the courage to leave her husband and to ask herself something she had never asked before. What do I want to do? Remembering her teenage love of dance, she signed up for pole dancing fitness class, where she met a former cheerleader for the Cincinnati Bengals. When the woman suggested that Laura audition to be a Bengal, Laura laughed her off. But soon she realized the audition process could be a way of healing herself and regaining her confidence. She tried out for the team next to girls who were young enough to be her daughters. Girls with tight abs, fuller hair, no kids, and no crow's feet. After much adversity and multiple auditions, she made the team, becoming the oldest cheerleader in the league. The book, written with Amy Son and narrated by Laura, follows her inspiring, funny journey from demoralized divorcee to high-kicking Cincinnati Bengal. Along the way, she takes hip-hop classes with 12-year-olds, loses 25 pounds, discovers her own abs, finds love again, and becomes a new kind of role model to her daughters. You'll also get an insider look into the fascinating world of NFL cheerleaders, the workouts, the bad pay, the twice weekly weigh-ins, but most important, the lifelong bond among the women.
Our game day uniform, which we take home after every game and must return when we retire from the team, is a micro mini skirt in orange and black and a white and orange halter top with a rhinestone B between the breasts. We wear calf-high, low-heeled white leather boots shipped to us from a small shop in Los Angeles. They are the only thing I will get to keep at the end of the season. Beneath our skirts, which have a built-in panty, our legs are encased in suntan-color leg sheer energy pantyhose with the waistband removed so we don't have muffin tops and the toes cut off so we have circulation. We are all wearing tan, heavy foundation, fake eyelashes, and French manicured or clear polished nails, as required by our rule book. Some of us have foundation or powder on our stomachs to give us great abs, whether we really have them or not. If you took all the silicone bra inserts, which we call chicken cutlets, that girls have stuffed inside their halters and put them in a pile, it would be about the size of a linebacker. I myself need no chicken cutlets. I got breast implants almost a year before, as part of the same midlife crisis that led me to believe I could get on the Bengals and perimenopause. Real or fake, each set of boobs is pressed together and up. On our mouths, we wear a hideous bright orange lipstick, Orange Flip by Revlon. It makes you look like someone's pushy grandmother who leaves kiss marks on your cheeks after she greets you. The Bengals have been wearing it for decades. We pass the players' locker room, which always feels forbidden. Cheerleaders are not allowed to enter the room at any point. I have memorized the white sign on the door. Notice, no person except authorized club and league personnel and accredited members of the media shall be permitted to enter the locker room of any participating club on the day of the game. The locker room door is connected to the tunnel by a yellow brick road. It's not really yellow, but a gray, black, and orange pattern that leads the boys to the field before a game and from the field after a nail-biting victory or humiliating loss. We are not allowed to step on the road lest we get in their way. The boys are streaming in on their way back to the locker room after their warm-up exercises. Chad Ochocinco, who changed his last name from Johnson to Ochocinco to match his jersey number, 85, and Dahani Jones are coming toward us. We avert our eyes, not wanting to distract them, but we peek at their faces to gauge their pregame state of mind. It's almost 7:30 at night, but we have been at the stadium over 4 hours. Practicing, eating an early dinner, and getting ready. We have been here longer than some of the players. We form small groups, touching our toes and doing lunges, warming up our muscles. We arrange ourselves into a circle to the side of the Bengal Brick Road and say a quick prayer, led by Tara, our captain, a leggy brunette with deep, dark brown eyes, a straight little nose, and wavy hair so long it touches her elbows. We stand shoulder to shoulder, cross our arms in front of our chests, and link pinkies because our palms, cheerleaders speak for pom-poms, prevent us from holding hands. Tara lowers her head and says, "Lord, thank you for allowing us to be here today and for keeping us safe. Make sure the fans are safe, the players are safe, and we are safe. Make sure everyone gets home all right after the game. Thank you for making sure we have no injuries and for allowing us to cheer. Amen," we say in unison. We all stand, hands on hips, and bend our right knees. This is Bengal pose. We will do it 100 more times over the course of the game, at the end of our short dances, the fillers. We shake our palms just below our breasts and say, "Yay," quietly, so as not to disturb the officials around us. Then we go into the tunnel. I get chills. It's short, maybe 40 feet or so. Just a passage with air vents, decorated with Bengals banners. But it feels holy to me.
That was It's Not About the Pom-Poms by Laura McManus. The Limpopo Academy of Private Detection is number 13 in Alexander McCall Smith's wildly popular number one ladies detective agency series. If you're a fan, and who isn't if you've heard one, you know that Precious Ramotswe is also a mother. In this book, Ma Ramotswe's attention is focused on a pesky disciplinary problem at her adopted daughter's school, while her assistant, Grace Makutsi, adjusts to wedded bliss, and amazingly, the famed Clovis Anderson arrives in Botswana looking for more than bush tea. To complement the story, Lisette Lacotte narrates once again.
It wasn't in any way a bad dream, nor was it a particularly good dream, the sort of dream that makes one feel as if one has been vouchsafed some great mystical insight. It was rather one of those dreams that seems to be a clear warning that something special is about to happen. If a dream involves lottery tickets and numbers, then its meaning is clear enough. This dream was not like that, and yet it left Maramotswe feeling that she had somehow been given advance notice of something out of the ordinary, something important. In this dream, she was walking along a path in the stretch of bush immediately behind Clockwang Road Speedy Motors, the building that the number one ladies' detective agency shared with Mr. J.L.B. Mattaconi's garage. She wasn't sure where she was going, but this didn't seem to matter, as Maramotswe felt happy just to be walking along it with no great sense of having to reach a destination. And why should one not walk along a path, particularly a comfortable path, without any idea of getting anywhere? She turned a corner and found herself faced with a large acacia tree, its foliage extending out like the canopy of a commodious umbrella. To dream of trees is to long for trees, and finding herself under the shade of this tree would have been enough to make the dream a satisfactory one. But there was more to it. Underneath the tree, standing in such a position that the mottled shade of the leaves all but obscured his face, was a tall, well-built man. He now stepped forward, held out a hand, and said, "I have come at last, Maramotswe." And that was the point at which Maramotswe awoke. The encounter with this stranger had not been threatening in any way. There'd been nothing in his demeanour that was suggestive of hostility, and she hadn't felt in the slightest bit anxious. As for what he said, she'd simply thought, even if she hadn't had the time to say it, "Yes, it has been a long time." For a few minutes after waking, she'd lain still in bed, mulling over the dream. Had the man been her father? Then the dream would have been easy to understand. She knew that she dreamed of her father from time to time, which was only to be expected, given that not a day went past, not one day, when she didn't think of that great and good man, the late Obed Ramotswe. If you think of somebody every day, then you can be sure you will dream of him at night. But it wasn't him whom she encountered under that acacia tree. That was very clear. It was somebody quite different. Somebody she sensed was from a long way away. But who could that be? Maramotswe didn't really know anybody from a long way away, unless one counted Francistown or Maun, where she knew a number of people. But those towns, although several hundred miles from Gaborone, are both in Botswana, and nowhere in Botswana was the abode of strangers. That was because Botswana, to those who lived there, was home, and familiar, and comfortable, and no place in such a country will seem far away. No, this man under the tree was from somewhere outside the country. And that was unusual and puzzling, and would have to be thought about at some length. "I had a very unusual dream," she said to Mama Kutsi as they attended to the morning's mail in the office. Mama Kutsi looked up from the envelope that she was in the process of slitting open. "Dreams are always unusual," she said. "In fact, it is unusual to have a usual dream."
We've just heard The Limpopo Academy of Private Detection by Alexander McCall Smith. In this side-splitting memoir, Girl Walks Into a Bar, Comedy Calamities, Dating Disasters, and a Midlife Miracle, Rachel Dratch, the former Saturday Night Live star, recounts the hilarious adventures and unexpected joy of dating and then becoming a mother at age 44. Anyone who saw an episode of Saturday Night Live between 1999 and 2006 knows Rachel Dratch. So what happened to her? After a misbegotten part as Jenna on the pilot of 30 Rock, Dratch was only getting offered roles as lesbians, secretaries, and sometimes secretaries who are also lesbians. Her career at a low point, Dratch suddenly had time for yoga, dog sitting, learning Spanish, and dating. After all, what did a 40-something single woman living in New York have to lose? Resigned to childlessness but still hoping for romance, Dratch was out for drinks with a friend when she met John. Handsome and funny, after only 6 months of dating long distance, he became the inadvertent father of a wholly unplanned-for and undreamed-of child. With riotous humor, Dratch recounts breaking the news to her bewildered parents, the awe of her single friends, and the awkwardness of a baby care class where the instructor kept tossing out the F word. Filled with behind-the-scenes anecdotes from Saturday Night Live, this is a refreshing version of the Happily Ever After story. The author narrates.
I was a cast member on Saturday Night Live for 7 years. Then my contract was up. I was going to be starring in a new show called 30 Rock in the role of Jenna. Have you guys seen 30 Rock? Yeah, I'm not Jenna. That was back in 2006, and strangers still ask me, why aren't you on 30 Rock? What happened with 30 Rock? Are we going to see you on more 30 Rock? 30 Rock. If you are one of those, oh, I don't have a television people, then I will give you a brief background. Of course, if you don't have a television, then none of the following will matter to you. But let me tell you, this is the very important stuff you are missing while you are playing the fiddle or telling stories by firelight or whatever it is you do instead of watching TV. 30 Rock is a show about the backstage happenings at an SNL-type comedy show called The Girly Show, created by and starring Tina Fey, produced by Lorne Michaels, who, for you actively non-TV people, is also the creator and producer of Saturday Night Live. Also starring Alec Baldwin and four other actors Tina had worked with previously, Tracy Morgan from SNL, Jack McBrayer and Scott Adsit from Second City, and briefly, me from both SNL and Second City. After we shot the pilot, I got a call from my agent. They're changing the show. Or he may have said, they're going in a different direction. In showbiz, you hear that phrase a lot. At best, it means you are being replaced by a black man. Oh, I couldn't have done that part. Now it's about a black man. The character of Susie is now named Jamal. See? They went in a different direction. At worst, the different direction is the direction of away from you, as in, we don't much care for you. At the time, I was not even upset by this news. I was told that the show, which in the pilot had included real sketches within the context of the sitcom, was now no longer going to have sketches. Instead of a sketch performer, they wanted more of a sitcom ingenue type. If you have been in the acting business for any length of time, you don't take this stuff personally. Replacements in pilots happen all the time. Everyone always refers to the fact that Lisa Kudrow was replaced on Frasier, and look what happened to her. She went on to do Friends. It's the anecdote that always gets trotted out of the barn whenever an actor is consoling another for being kicked off a job. Besides, Tina called me up and said that instead of Jenna, she had thought up a different role for me to play. Actually, many roles. I would appear in various episodes as a different character each time, popping up in the show in all sorts of incarnations. I thought this idea was unique. I'd never seen anything like it before, and I thought it could be fun to be a sort of Where's Waldo character within the show. Plus, I felt way more comfortable doing these kind of parts than playing Jenna, a diva type who, in the pilot, sort of tries to seduce Alec Baldwin. No one needs to see me try to seduce. I think that would be grim and awkward for all parties involved. I felt fine about the whole situation, and then things started to go in a different direction. For one thing, this story became instantly public. Before, I had a mild level of fame, not the type to land me in a blurb in Vanity Fair. Spotted dining in one of New York's hotspots, Rachel Dratch had the duck confit. But after I got replaced on the pilot by Jane Krakowski, oh boy, was I a celebrity. I had never been this mentioned in the press or this buzzed about for my whole career until now that something bad was happening. Someone's getting fired? Tell me everything. Now wait, who is Rachel Dratch again? It was everywhere. What a downer for Dratch, read the articles. And here's where the story turns ugly. Literally. The general opinion seemed to be that it wasn't about sitcom or sketch. It was about attractiveness. It was about pretty. The internet, magazines, and news stories all gingerly speculated that I had been replaced by a more attractive actor and that this was the only reason I had been replaced. Well, the newspapers and magazines did so gingerly. There was nothing gingerly about the internet.
That was Girl Walks Into a Bar by Rachel Dratch. Readers, thanks so much for joining us on Mother's Day. I hope you have an amazing weekend. Maybe even you'll have some time to pick up a book and have some mom time. For ideas, make sure to check our website, bookreportradio.com. And see you back here next week. on The Book Report.